At the turn of the 14th century, a fierce controversy rocked the intellectual world of the rabbis of Spain, a controversy primarily surrounding the works of the Rambam or Maimonides, but it extended to debating the entire intellectual tradition that he represented, whether or not the religious Jewish tradition can and should be served by the study of philosophy and the sciences. In the heat of this debate, around the year 1305, we have a letter from Rabbi Yedaya HaPanini, or Rabbi Yedaya Bidursi, from Bezir, writing to the greatest rabbi of the generation, the Rashba, or of Shlomo ibn Aderet. He writes in a letter that has been preserved in the collection of responsa of the Rashba, that the Rambam was just one great rabbi in a long line of great Torah sages from Spain who made important use of the study of philosophy and the sciences, Reb Yitzchak ibn Giat, Reb Moshe ibn Ezra, Reb Shlomo ibn Gabirol, all of whom composed wonderful books and have helped guide the Jewish people. But there's one who rose above the rest. Reb Yedaya writes, Reb Yehuda Halevi, Mispa'er be'enei hachachmos b'tilosav u'piotav hanifloim. He glorified himself, adorned himself with matters of wisdom in his wonderful prayers and beautiful liturgical poetry. Uimenu etzlenu od sefer hakuzari. And from him we also have the book of the Kuzari. Hiflig lachkor uluvar b'sitrei haTorah v'anevuos, altsad haskomas hadas v'amuskol, b'chol kocho. Regarding the Sefer HaKuzari, he went farther than anyone before him in investigating and explaining the secrets of the Torah and prophecy, explaining them by way of agreement and reason, with all his might, Yoser mikol asher hayu lefanav, more than anyone who had ever been able to do before him. We see, nearly 150 years after this book, the Kuzari, was written, it was praised as the greatest expression of the rationality of the Jewish faith, and from then on, you can find similar statements about the Book of the Kuzari from the greatest rabbinic thinkers in almost every subsequent century. From Rabbi Yedaya HaPanini to Ramban to Shem Tov Ibn Shem Tov to Rabbi Azariah di Rossi, the great Italian Jewish scholar who uses the Kuzari as his example in so many instances, to the Maharal, whose life's work was a critique on Rebbe Azariah di Rossi, who also shows heavy influence from the Kuzari, a tradition attributed to the great Gaon of Vilna, even if it only appeared nearly 100 years after his death, quotes this Vilna Gaon as saying that instead of studying any of the other philosophical works of the great Rishonim who attempted to prove God using logic, one should instead learn the Book of the Kuzari, which is holy and pure, and the fundamentals of Israel's faith and of the Torah hang upon this book, upon the Book of the Kuzari. And we can go on and on with praises of this incredible book, down to the 20th century, when the Book of the Kuzari was made a central pillar of the educational philosophy of Rav Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Kuk, and especially his son, Rav Tzvi Yehuda. The book is mentioned by Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik as being absolutely necessary, essential, to be studied by every rabbinic student, was also considered so important by Rabbi Chezkel Sarna, the great Rosh Yeshiva of Slobodka of Chevron Yeshiva, who reworked and rearranged the Kuzari to make it more accessible to a wider array of students. What is it about this amazing book that contains the fundamentals of the Jewish faith, the fundamentals of Torah? That's what we'll hopefully get at least a little taste of this absolutely incredible classic of Jewish literature, the great Book of the Kuzari by Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. Hello and welcome to the Rishonim podcast. This is now the third episode on the works of the great Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, the exceptionally gifted poet and religious thinker whose life story and poetry we explored in the first episode on Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. And in the previous episode, we began exploring his gorgeous work that's known as the Kuzari, just by discussing his framing of the book and the main argument that he puts forth. What I've argued is a 3-layered argument for the truth of the Jewish religion and its Torah. And even though I think that it's this argument, which is what the Book of the Kuzari is most well known for, that is hardly the only thing in the book. And especially given just how much influence it's had, and how much I love this book, and think it is just so chock full of fascinating, incredible stuff, that I really felt the need to do another episode on this Book of the Kuzari, and not just leave it at what the previous episode was basically just an exploration of the first 10 pages. But really, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi has so much more to say. I think so many insights that are just brilliant, intriguing, even if they're very difficult, they still provide a lot of food for thought. Even if we might not want to adopt all of his ideas or find one or two of his ideas to not be so representative, perhaps, of a mainstream Jewish view, even in those cases, the Kuzari is a book that is worth delving into. It is, like I keep mentioning, the definition of a classic, a work that has had influence on many centuries of readers, and to this day, you can still look at it closely and still find tremendous depth and richness that it really, really rewards a close reading. So to that end, I want to share some of the amazing ideas in this book, but I'll admit I was a little bit torn as to how to present this episode. This is, in fact, the second time I'm trying this, because at first I was thinking to discuss 10 major ideas that appear throughout the Book of the Kuzari and explore those 10 ideas as they appear in various places. And the reason why I think that may be a good way to approach this book, and it has in fact to some extent been done by Rabbi Yechezkel Sarna, he rearranged a lot of the ideas in the Book of the Kuzari into topics, and that's really useful. You kind of need something like that, because the Book of the Kuzari is presented as a conversation. It's a conversation between the Khazar king and the Chaver, the rabbinic figure in the book. And Rabbi Yehuda Halevi really leaned into that style of writing, making it seem like a conversation, to the point where the book is actually really not organized by topic. They just wander about from idea to idea as they come up, the way that a normal conversation would flow. They go off on tangents, then they come back to their original idea, then the king says, actually, now I want to talk about something completely different, and ask new questions, and then go back to old ideas to flesh them out more. And in fact, I think every major idea of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi that's presented in the Kuzari can be found at least twice. Even kind of some random ideas, like the definition of Kedusha, for example, it appears twice. And that's sort of because it comes up in different topics, but it's just the nature of the conversation. His ideas about Shabbos, about exile, about how prophecy works, all the major ideas, and that's not even the major ideas that I was just mentioning. Those are even more minor ideas. Even those appear at least twice, or three, or five, or 10 times throughout the book in different places and in different ways. And so, as I mentioned, at first I was thinking of doing this episode by presenting 10 different topics that are dealt with in the Book of the Kuzari, and for each of those topics, piecing together the 5 to 15 instances where they appear throughout the book. And I actually decided against doing that. I'm not going to do that, but I am mentioning it because I think that's valid and useful. And what I did instead is I put that information that I was thinking of saying on the source sheet that is attached to this episode. Every episode of the Rishonim podcast has an accompanying source sheet that should be really easy to find, either in the show notes for this episode on your podcast player or however you found it on the internet. If you only have the audio file, you can at least go on my website, which is sites.google.com/view/Rishonim, R-I-S-H-O-N-I-M. That's where you can find all of the audio to all the episodes and all of the source sheets, as well as a couple of other random things. So on the source sheet, I have 10 recurring topics and just the citations where in the Kuzari you can find those topics so that you can piece all those fragments together yourself. Now, I know you might be thinking, I'm trying to listen to a podcast here. Why is this podcasting guy giving me some really difficult homework assignment? And the reason is because I'm actually trying to give you an even harder homework assignment, which is to read the book. Read the whole book of the Kuzari. I really honestly think that that is necessary if you want to be an educated, or I should say, if you care about the Jewish intellectual tradition of the theory behind traditional Judaism, I really think you need to know this book. Maybe not actually the whole thing, just like till the middle of book four, but we'll talk about that. But that's why I have on the source sheet these citations of recurring themes to demonstrate how, besides for just reading the Book of the Kuzari, to really actually get at its incredible depth and richness, you really have to put these pieces together and see how Rabbi Yehuda Halevi discusses the same idea from multiple different angles. It's, in a way, I'll talk about this a lot, I think, part of what makes the book so reflective of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi as a poet, that his great skill might not have been conveying ideas in the most perfectly precise, organized manner. He conveys ideas more like the way a poet would, by talking also about how he feels about them, in all kinds of different ways and with different metaphors. It's not obvious the first time you read the book that it's written by a poet, because he doesn't use flowery language. He doesn't embellish on his ideas with many synonyms and metaphors, but he doesn't do it concisely either. Anyway, I'm kind of getting ahead of myself, as I often do. I meant to talk about what I'm actually going to do, Be'ezra Hashem, in this episode, which is, instead of talking about some of the major ideas in the Kuzari by arranging them into topics, instead, I want to sort of go through the flow of the entire book of the Kuzari, the way that it goes from topic to topic, and that way, hopefully I can explain a little bit, give some order to the disorder that is kind of inherent in this conversation. But also, the main reason why I want to do it that way is because that way I can highlight some of my favorite random things that don't necessarily fit into, let's say, the 10 big ideas of the Kuzari's recurring themes. Some things are just fun and interesting, and I want to talk about that once again to get you to read the book. And I also, on the other hand, I don't want anyone to listen to this and think, ah, now I know what it says in the Book of the Kuzari, and use this podcast instead of actually reading the book, Chas V'Shalom. And so this way, I can go through the book and tell you some of the questions that the Kuzari brings up without giving you the answers. But in this case too, hopefully I've made this a little bit easier for you if you want to try to go through the Book of the Kuzari or find some specific ideas or see how a specific idea fits in the context of where it appears. So also on this source sheet that I mentioned is something like a table of contents for the Book of the Kuzari. It's something that I made after reading through the book several times, but it's definitely not super, like, set in stone. You can definitely argue about, you know, is this section really a subsection of this other conversation, or really this is a new kind of conversation, or the Kuzari here is going off topic, or it's actually connected to the previous topic, things like that. I may have squashed a lot of important details, or erased some important details in this table of contents or outline that I made for the Book of the Kuzari. So you can't really rely on that either, but hopefully it is at least sort of helpful for someone who wants to go through the book, especially if you first are only interested in looking at certain parts, or you've tried to read the book before and you just couldn't make heads or tails of the thing because of how the Kuzari keeps jumping around topics and sort of circling an idea without saying it outright sometimes. So hopefully this is all helpful for that kind of study. Now, I think I was just guilty of the very thing that I was saying the Kuzari does, which is presenting ideas in a not very well-structured way. So now I want to say again, better this time, what I will and will not do, Be'ezra Hashem, in this podcast episode. I was just saying that I decided not to identify some of the major topics and go through them and discuss how the Kuzari presents his major ideas based on collecting the various statements he says about them throughout the Book of the Kuzari, because they are spread all about the Book of the Kuzari. And the reason for this, let me now explain more clearly this time, because I also want to tell you how you could do this. But in theory, this could be done in one of two ways. One way would be to just collect all of the times that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi in the Kuzari mentions a certain topic, and then just read them together. I think, number one, that's boring and annoying, because you could just do that yourself. And number two is, even if I simplified them, that has already been done, as I mentioned in Rabbi Chazkel Sarna's reworking of the Kuzari, to make it simple. And I really think that is the kind of thing that lends itself more to a book. And if you want to read the originals instead of a simplified version, then I have at least done the work for you of taking those topics that I would have discussed and providing the citations where in the Kuzari you can find, for example, all of the instances where the Kuzari talks about Shabbos or about exile. So that's all one way that I could have approached this that I don't think is useful. But the other way is, instead of simplifying all of what the Kuzari has to say on a topic, is to do the opposite, is to collect all of those citations and really try to delve deeply into them in order to gain a complete picture by putting all the puzzle pieces together and seeing how the Kuzari presents something from all the different vantage points and how those fit together. That is the kind of thing that requires reading the Kuzari very closely. It takes a lot of time, and that's also really hard to do on a podcast. I think if you're listening to this while you're doing dishes or driving or riding an elephant, it's hard to follow along if you need to be paying attention to precise language. So that's one reason why I don't want to do that. But another big reason is because I myself, I'm not really sure. In fact, I'm very sure that I did not get to the bottom of these topics in my own mind. I'm not sure to what extent I really fully understand the depths of the Kuzari's opinion on many of these matters. There are a few of these topics that Be'ezras Hashem, I am working on writing up to publish in an article in Hebrew someday, somewhere. Although all that always takes so much more time than I think it should. But anyways, that's also something I would strongly encourage you to try to do. Why I'm not doing it, as I mentioned, number one, hard to do on a podcast. Number two, it's anyways much deeper than I could present. And number three is, just like I mentioned Rav Chatzkel Sarna's reworking of the Kuzari, I also want to mention another really good resource for a really accessible but still pretty thorough discussion of the Kuzari's positions and ideas, which is a book by Rav Yitzchak Shilat, who did a translation of the Kuzari into modern Hebrew. He also worked on translating the Rambam's letters in a really important modern translation. And Rav Yitzchak Shilat wrote this book, Bein HaKuzari LaHarambam, where he goes through, I forgot how many chapters there are, maybe 10, 15, something like that, but something like a dozen different topics, and shows how in each of those topics, the Kuzari has a particular vision, a particular position on how to understand that topic within Torah Judaism, and he compares the position of the Kuzari with the position of the Rambam. And I think that's actually really, really useful. He really did such a good job. He doesn't need my approval. He's well known, especially among Rosh Yeshiva, as one of the real great experts on the thought of the Rambam and the Kuzari. So all that is to say what I'm not going to do, but hopefully I've provided plenty of resources to help you with your homework that I have assigned. And like with any homework, by the way, feel free to hand in your completed homeworks to me. I would love to hear from anyone listening if you have what you think is a really nice chiddush, some big question, even if you don't have an answer, on the Kuzari as you work through it, or some really interesting idea. Once again, as I always say, the reason why I'm doing this podcast is not because I'm an expert on the Rishonim. It's because I love the Rishonim, and I want to hear what any of you might have to say about it also. Now we can get on to what I actually do want to discuss in this episode of the podcast, which is to sort of run through at a very high level this amazing book of the Kuzari. I'll be your tour guide here as we zoom through all of the interesting sights, even if we don't have time to actually stop and take pictures and smell the flowers. I don't know if that's a good or terrible metaphor for what I'm trying to do. It's often how I describe the experience of learning Daf Yomi in the Gemara, which is like taking a high-speed train on a tour through the entire world, and you have a tour guide saying like, oh, look at the out the window, and you can see the most incredible, oh, there it's gone. Sorry, we passed it. On to the next thing. Oh, look, there's the, oh, no, it's gone now. Anyway, no offense to anyone who learns Daf Yomi. It's just that sometimes it can be a little frustrating when you don't have time to explore the sites because you're so focused on covering ground. But that's what I'm going to try to do now with one of my most favorite books of all time, to hopefully encourage you to get off the train at certain points to actually look around. All right, I don't know why I'm babbling with this one. But to start off, I want to quickly mention what took me 2 hours to discuss on the previous episode, which is the book's frame story. It starts off with a king from a faraway land, the kingdom of Khazar or Khazaria. The king of the Khazars is very religious, but he has a dream saying that he's not following the correct religion, and so he goes about trying to investigate what is the true path to serving God. And in order to do this, he first invites a philosopher into his royal court. The philosopher gives him a speech about what they believe is the true path to God and enlightenment and immortality, which is to perfect one's intellect to the point where it is similar to and can attach itself to the divine intellect. That's basically the crux of the philosopher's speech. And the king of the Khazars doesn't like this because he says, number one, it contradicts my dream, which is that God is looking for certain actions, not just my intellect. And number two is that it contradicts what everyone believes, which is if you look around, you'll see Christians and Muslims fighting each other for dominance. They both believe the other religion to be heretical. So clearly, most people do not think that in order to get to God, it's sufficient to just perfect your intellect and be a good person. If you look around, you see that the major religions of the world, they all believe that you have to perform specific actions or believe certain specific doctrines that have to do with God and his involvement in history. And he has another objection, a third objection, that's also based on his knowledge of other religions and world history, which is that he's never heard of any philosophers who become prophets. And even though these philosophers, they meditate for hours and hours on end, for weeks and months and years, decades, I've never heard of anyone getting to the level of prophecy, so they must not be doing it right. So these are, in a nutshell, the three objections that the Kuzari has to the philosopher. It contradicts his dream. It contradicts what most normal people believe if they belong to any of the major world religions of Christianity and Islam. And number three, because the philosophers don't become prophets. And quickly, I'll review what we said in the previous episode, which is that these objections actually sound kind of weird. Maybe prophecy is impossible. Maybe your dream, O King of Khazars, was just a dream. And you're talking about the Muslims and Christians who are fighting each other. Well, obviously, they're not both going to be right, so maybe none of them are right. And so to quickly review what we discussed in the previous episode, as I mentioned, that took me 2 hours, is that the whole argument of the Kuzari is actually working at three different levels that are all sort of playing off of each other. Three ways that the King of Khazars believes is the appropriate way to reason about the world, the methods by which a person gets to true knowledge, what I might call, if I was a stuffy philosophy professor who wore a bow tie and tweed jackets, I'd call them three epistemic modes, M-O-D-E-S, three ways of thinking of how to get to knowledge. I've never worn a bow tie, so I'm not going to use that phrase again. But the three methods are, number one, an appeal to what we might call today common sense or universal reason, which I'll explain is a little bit different than pure rationality, but it's closely related, because rationality is based upon principles that everyone agrees to, but universal reason is a lot more expansive than that. It's what would generally seem reasonable to the vast majority of people. That's one way of getting at the truth. Another way, number two, is learning it from reliable teachers. That's why the king of the Khazars is looking specifically for prophets. And number three is direct experience of the senses. That is, in a way, the most reliable method of gaining knowledge of the world, if you can experience it directly. And all of these three methods or levels, they all play upon each other. They all kind of rely on each other. Most people, most of the time, will trust what they experience with their own senses. If you can't experience something directly, then the second best way to find out true information is to talk to someone who did experience it directly. But you have to use your own common sense and your own reason in order to evaluate the validity of that person's, let's say, testimony. And how are you going to be doing that? You're going to be appealing to common sense type principles, a type of rationality that makes sense to most people. I think that this is all contained just in the first few pages. In the Khuzari's objections to the philosopher, he rejects the philosopher because of, number one, his own experiences, which are his dreams, because of the beliefs of most ordinary people, which are Christians and Muslims in his view, and because it doesn't seem to him like they have the appropriate experiences that would lead a person to divine knowledge. He has never heard of any of the philosophers becoming prophets. And here, already he mentions something very interesting. I think all of these are interesting and going to be running throughout the whole rest of the book. But one that I want to highlight now, in addition to those things that we had discussed in the previous episode, which is how the Khazar king already conceives of the idea of prophecy. Because he points out to the philosopher that if there are all these people who are meditating in the mountains, trying to perfect their intellects and becoming perfectly spiritual people in that sense, and yet they're not becoming prophets, that proves that prophecy is actually totally separate. It's totally independent from intellectual achievement. It must be dependent upon something else. And he uses this Arabic phrase, it must be that the Amar al-Ilahi, this divine something, this godly thing, it must have some secret that the philosopher doesn't know about. This Arabic phrase comes up a lot throughout the Book of the Khuzari, and it's been the subject, actually, of quite a lot of scholarship because it's an ambiguous term. It just means a godly thing, a something. Ibn Tibbon translates it as Inyan Eloki. But Rav Yosef Kapach and the more recent translation of Michal Schwartz, they translate it as Davar Eloki, which is very nice because the word Davar in Hebrew, it means thing, but it also means word. And that's sometimes how the Khuzari refers to it also. Like here, especially, it might be ambiguous. Does he mean a divine, like, spirit? Or does he mean actual divine communication, which is the result of prophecy, of God speaking through a person? And there's one place in particular where Rabbi Yehuda Halevi makes a pun on these two different meanings of the phrase. He'll later say that the only way to get to the divine thing, meaning the only way to come close to God, is through following his words. The only way to get to the Amar al-Ilahi is to follow the Amar al-Ilahi. So that's just one of the many, many important Arabic terms that actually have some technical meaning in the Khuzari that he uses just here in the first few paragraphs of the book in order to reject the philosopher. After sending the philosopher away, the Khazar says, let me speak to the Christians and the Muslims. One of them must have the correct religion. And the Christian starts off satisfying what the Khuzari is looking for by talking about the Amar al-Ilahi, saying that the Jews used to have this, but they lost it because they sinned and they were replaced by the Christians. And the Christians believe this really wacky thing about God that he is like sort of three or something like that. And the king of the Khazar says, well, that really doesn't make any sense. But it's interesting how I brought this up in the previous episode, because I think it's really important. It's interesting how the King of the Khazars thinks that it's not crazy for the Christian to believe something totally irrational, which is that 3 and 1 are somehow the same number. Because if that's what they experienced through some sort of prophetic vision that was accompanied by miracles or something like that, if you can prove that that is in fact the case through experience, and then even if I don't have that experience, but if someone who did have that experience can be relied upon, then it's actually not so crazy to believe this irrational thing. So that's his sort of very diplomatic way to dismiss the Christian by saying, what you say might make sense for you, but it doesn't make sense for me. Which is just such a fascinating and not very forceful rejection of another religion that it could be that the reason why Rabbi Yehuda Halevi has these very soft rejections, and the rejection of Islam is going to be very similar. It could be that he was worried about censorship and those kinds of things. Like, it may not have been so safe for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi to publish a book in Arabic that would be criticizing Islam, especially, and maybe if he was living in a Christian country or living very close to where the Christians were dominant, he didn't want to really insult the Christian beliefs either. So it could be that that's also kind of what's going on behind the scenes. There's actually a very interesting sort of retelling of the story of the Khuzari in the book Shevet Yehuda by Reb Shlomo Ibn Verga. It's one of the really classic works of Jewish history. It's like not exactly the kind of history that we would write today. It's very stylized, it has all these stories, it's meant to be an accounting of the various troubles and tribulations that the Jewish people experienced through their exile. And this book, the Shevet Yehuda, actually is considered recommended reading by the Mishnah Brura. But anyway, so this book also includes a story that's like a retelling of the Khuzari, and the rabbi in the story says to a Christian king, which is how it's presented, that he's not saying that the Christian should convert to Judaism, because Christianity makes perfect sense for you, O Christian king, because of your historical experiences through Christianity. And God wanted Christians to be Christians and Jews to be Jews, because only the Jewish people had the unique historical experiences that make sense in the context of Judaism. It's a fascinating line about religious relativism, that it almost sounds like he's saying each religion is true for the members who actually follow that religion, even though from the Jewish perspective, it would be complete heresy, which is honestly a very, very radical proposition that I think, again, might have just been in the book because the Shevet Yehuda didn't want to insult Christianity too much for political reasons. Like, he was afraid of either the book being censored or him getting in trouble if he were to really say that actually, no, Christianity is 100% wrong. But anyway, going back now to the Khuzari, this is how he rejects the Christian. He rejects the Muslim in a kind of similar way, saying that the Muslim says, I experience God's word through the Quran. And the King of the Khazar says, great for you, but I don't speak Arabic, so I can't experience that. The Muslim also indicates that the Jewish people used to have this Amar al-Ilahi, but lost it. And so then the Khazar king says, okay, fine, so I guess I have to invite a Jew to the palace to explain to me what he believes. So he does that. He invites a Khaver, what today we would call a rabbi. And the Khaver says he believes in the God of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, who did many miracles for the Israelites. And the Khazar is really upset about that answer. Again, I spoke about this in the previous episode. If you didn't listen to that already, then what are you doing? Please stop and listen to that episode first. But now that you have listened to that episode, I won't go through all this again. That the Khazar gives an analogy, a parable about a king of India, that you can't use pure reason and rationality to just derive the fact that India has a king just from pure reason. The most reliable way to know that India has a king is if you interact with him. If the king of India sent you gifts that could only possibly have come from India, along with letters explaining the terms of this gift and why he's giving it to you and how to use them, all kinds of things like that. And then you don't just know that the King of India exists as some philosophical proposition, but you actually now have a relationship with him. And that is the primary difference between knowing something just by philosophical argument and knowing something based on your own experience. And the meaning of the parable is that God also is not to be believed as a proposition of abstract philosophy. Although interestingly, and maybe I'll come back to this, the Chavar does mention that there might actually be something called like logical religion or a religion of reason that maybe in theory you could derive it if you were particularly brilliant, but it would still not be the religion of the Jewish people. The Jewish people don't believe that a God exists. They believe in the God who had a relationship with the Jewish people because he revealed himself to the Jewish prophets and gave the Jewish people innumerable gifts, had deep relationships with the forefathers of the Jewish people, and the whole nation experienced God's presence in their wanderings through the desert from Egypt to the land of Israel. And then once they got to the land of Israel, through, once again, this Amar al-Ilahi, this divine presence, this divine thing that was constantly accompanying them throughout the times that the temple stood in the land of Israel. And it's this concrete relationship level knowledge of God that is represented by how he introduced himself in the greatest revelation that ever happened. This was at Har Sinai, at Mount Sinai. There were these crazy lights and sounds and fire and shofar and cloud, the most spectacular fireworks display of all time. And the nation heard God's voice saying, "I am God who brought you out of Egypt." And he specifically introduces himself as the one who brought you out of Egypt instead of the creator of the world, because the Jewish people didn't experience the creator, the creation of the world. That's like a philosophical concept. But here, what is starting, or continuing at least, with this revelation is this God who is engaging in a relationship with the Jewish people, who already had a relationship with their forefathers and blessed their forefathers with tremendous gifts, and that they saw with their own eyes how God had took them out of slavery with incredible, incredible miracles, punishing and making a mockery out of the Egyptians and their belief system. Now that the rabbi, the Chavar, has justified his religious outlook, why he speaks about God as a being who he has a relationship with, the king of the Khazars responds, "Well, okay, fine, that's a great story you have there, but that relationship is unique to you guys, to the historical Jewish people, and if it's true, then your Torah is only for you." So it sounds like the king of the Khazars is stating this as an objection, but the Chavar actually maybe surprises him by agreeing, and he says, "Yep, that's right. You got it. That's exactly right. The Torah is just for us, just for the Jews, because we Jews were the best, the segula, the choicest of all of humanity." And the Chavar says this, mentioning the possibility of conversion, saying that even converts, they can join our nation, but they won't be as good because the Jews are the best. And as you might imagine, the Khazar is not very happy about this statement. Here's an indication that the book is a work of fiction. In real life, if the rabbi who was invited to the Khazar's palace said something so horribly insulting, he would probably be executed or at least thrown out of court. But in the book we're reading, the conversation continues with the king being super offended and the rabbi saying, "Wait, I can defend my claim." And the very tolerant, patient king of Khazars listens as the rabbi goes on sort of a tangent by talking about creatures in general. Just look at all the different types of creation. There are minerals, inanimate objects, what we would call vegetables, vegetation, plants is another category. A third category are animals, and the fourth category are human beings. All of these have capabilities that the, so to speak, lower categories of creation lack. So animals can move around and hunt for food in ways that plants cannot. Human beings can think and speak in ways that animals cannot. And the Khazar agrees to this kind of conceptual categorization of reality. And the Khaver says that actually there's also another category here. That category is if you imagine someone who can do something that normal humans cannot do. Imagine someone who's able to walk into fire unharmed, can go many, many weeks without food or drink, is capable of superhuman strength, and knows exactly when they're going to die. All of these things are basically the superhuman level. The Khazar Kings, sure, that's a superhuman. We'll call Superman a different species if he exists. And the rabbi tells him, yes, this kind of person does exist. It describes the prophet. I think in particular, he has in mind Moshe Rabbeinu, the greatest of all prophets. But this is what it means to have a person who is connected to God on this level where the normal rules of nature, the normal limitations of being human don't apply to that person. And then they go on a tangent upon the tangent, which is the Torah of Moshe is so wonderful in that it teaches all kinds of things that would be impossible to know without prophecy, like the age of the world and how languages came to be, all kinds of brilliant and fascinating things that all Jews agree upon all over the world because they all learn this from their Torah. And it also, he says, fits the evidence around the world really well. And once again, I know this is just a tangent upon a tangent, but he wants to show how the wisdom of the Torah is actually something that can be appreciated from a universal reason perspective. And so he's willing to answer challenges based on alternative traditions, like over the Indians, or based off of rational argumentation of the philosophers. The Khaver, the rabbi, is willing to entertain all that and respond to them because he does think that these prophetic teachings, these teachings of Moshe Rabbeinu, they should be consistent with the actual experience of the world, with evidence that you can actually see. And if you can prove something, then of course the Torah must be consistent with those truths because the Torah could never teach anything that's false. It's a statement that the Khaver actually returns to more than once. But all of this, as I mentioned, all of this is a tangent. What I'm trying to do here is explain the flow of the Book of the Kuzari. But he got sidetracked from what he was trying to do, which is answer the king's question. How can you demonstrate that there really is something special about the Jewish people? And the answer number one is because Jews have prophets. And prophets are something that you can really show, like the people who themselves are prophets, are demonstrably superhuman, and so they must belong to a separate class of, let's say, biology. They must be part of a different species, and it's only among the Jewish people that we find such prophets. That's the main explanation that the Khaver has to the king, how we know that the Jews are different. And the secondary demonstration is that the Torah, the wisdom of these prophets, is actually something you can appreciate, is something that he can demonstrate, even though the prophets themselves are long dead. And I should mention that within this tangent that the Khaver started talking about the wisdom of the Torah, he also started throwing in some ideas about the wondrous nature of the Hebrew language and how all of humanity descended from a common man through Adam. But he started talking about how only some of those human beings were fit to be prophets, to have this Amar al-Ilahi that I keep talking about, this divine thing, and it's associated with speaking the Hebrew language, which is the language that Adam spoke after the creation of multiple languages. It was only Aver who spoke this language, that's why it's called Ivri. Avraham continued to speak in this language, so he was called in Ivri himself. That's just all part of the tangent within the tangent within the tangent in the way that he presents it, but it is actually central to the idea that the rabbi is presenting, which is that anyone who is fit to be a prophet must be from a different biological species. Let me just quickly say what happens next. So in the modern editions of the Kuzari, There are numbers for the different paragraphs. So now we're at paragraph 68, where the king says, "We've gotten too distracted. Let's go back to something else I wanted to ask you, which is how and why God interacts with human beings." So the rabbi says something interesting about nature, which is what we call it, what we call everything that God does in conducting the world. I hope to return to that later, Be'ezras Hashem. He explains what is special about the divine instruction that is associated with prophecy, that it comes with these crazy miracles that are plainly evident for anyone who encounters them, who encounters this prophet who's bringing down the Torah, such as the incredible miracles that occurred at Har Sinai, the amazing, miraculous experience of having food fall from the sky every single day, 6 days a week for 40 years. That's pretty impressive. And he's going on and on about how wonderful the Jewish people are, that they were recipients of all of this divine goodness. And eventually the king stops him and says, "Wait a minute now, don't get too carried away praising your own people. You're missing something in the story here that I think I heard something really negative about the Jewish people. And that is that with all of these miracles that they experienced and with this relationship that they had with God, nevertheless, they made a golden calf that they served as an idol, and they rebelled against the God who did all these wonderful things for them." And kind of weirdly, it's in response to this challenge that the rabbi picks up on what he was talking about before, that the Jewish people are the segula, the choicest of all nations, that they're biologically superior as the select offspring of Adam. And it's in response to this question about the golden calf that he elaborates on this even more. And it sounds very much like he has something like a botanical metaphor in his mind, like something to do with plants. Like you imagine a seed, planting a seed in the ground, it sprouts and it grows into a tree, but some parts of the seed become the trunk, the branches, the leaves, the flowers. But like if you imagine all of the cells from the plant, and this plant keeps making all these more plant cells, only a few of those are actually going to be the fruit of the tree. This is disclaimer to anyone who studied developmental biology, that's not exactly how it works, but that seems to be what Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, through the mouth of this chaver, seems to have in mind. That there was Adam, there was the first human being, he was fit for the Amar ala Ilahi, the divine thing, and so he was able to communicate with God. He had children, only one of his children was fit to do so. It was first Hevel. Hevel was killed by Cain because he was jealous of this very thing, this divine thing, so that Adam had to have another child, Sheth. Sheth had many children, but only passed this ability to communicate with God to one of his children, who is named in the Torah. There's Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. And then after Yaakov, at that point, this divine thing stuck to the entire family of Yaakov and continued to be present in all of the descendants of Yaakov. And that's how we get to the Jewish people that are the most special of all humanity. Everyone else were, like he says, like shells that are inedible. And he points out it's not true that all Jewish people are going to be prophets, are going to have this communication with God, just like not all seeds from a fruit tree will actually bear fruit. Not all people are able to talk, like if they never learned how to do so. But the point is that they all have this ability if it could be properly cultivated. And the king actually seems pretty convinced by this. Then he reminds the chaver, like, "Hey, remember why you gave me this whole explanation was to answer the question about how could it be that the Jews rebelled by worshiping a golden calf so soon after experiencing God's presence at Har Sinai?" And then the chaver answers the question by actually explaining what was going on, and he has this whole very interesting theory about what exactly was going on with this sin of the golden calf. And I'll get back to that in a few minutes, but once again, I really, really want to focus on this very central but also very problematic view of the Book of the Kuzari, now that we've sort of presented it as it appears in this first essay, the first of the five books of the Sefer Kuzari. First, what I want to do is explain kind of where this is coming from and how Rabbi Yehuda Halevi thinks that he can really make a convincing argument to the truth of this claim that the Jewish people are actually a superior race. I think that's an accurate word, even if it might make us a little uncomfortable. So first of all, he tries to demonstrate this empirically, like from the actual real world. Because remember, for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, the most reliable information that we can get, especially about matters that can't be reasoned through just by pure rationality alone, the best way to get to that knowledge is through experience, is through actual lived reality. And he says the lived reality of the Jewish people in the time of the temple is that many of them became prophets. And prophecy wasn't just the ability to communicate with God. It actually came with being superhuman. And so he has this kind of scientific idea that just like you'll never find a talking animal, even if not all humans can talk, so the whole concept of prophecy, the whole concept of this Amar al-Ilahi is something that is beyond what humanity can experience as just human beings. So it must be that there's this separate biological entity, even if today there are no such prophets among the Jewish people because it just hasn't been cultivated properly. And that's kind of what he goes on throughout really the rest of the book to discuss how the Torah and its laws, if adhered to properly and if done in the right place in the land of Israel, along with the temple and the sacrifices, etc., etc., that is what can cultivate this ability among all the Jewish people. But that means that his racist theory is kind of a naturalistic one, and it comes with this kind of disturbing corollary, which I kind of skipped over, that the Chaver says to the king, it's impossible for someone who converts to Judaism to be a prophet, to truly have this divine experience, because no matter what he does, he can't change that biological difference. And so it's very interesting, there are some other later thinkers in Jewish tradition who also make statements to the effect of, well, Jews have something like a different soul than non-Jews. But almost all of the great Jewish thinkers who say something like that also believe that the soul is this immaterial, metaphysical, non-natural aspect of a person, or maybe they believe that only of a Jewish soul, but either way, someone who converts, then there's nothing stopping God from giving them a new soul. When they become part of the Jewish people, then they get a Jewish soul. According to the Kuzari, that's actually impossible. Or I shouldn't say impossible, but it would be a miracle that's totally out of the ordinary. That's not how conversion really works. Because again, his theory is based on what he understands as science, as the empirical proven reality shown from experiment that only Jews can be prophets. And I want to talk more about that, about converts in particular, and about prophecy in two or three more minutes. But first, I also just want to say, what is motivating Rabbi Yehuda Halevi towards this racist theory of the Jewish people? I mentioned, number one, that it's just based on his idea of science, but I think he has more motivations, let's say, more advantages that this theory has than just saying, well, it happens to be that the only people who have become prophets are Jews, which, by the way, is probably not going to be that convincing because, number one, maybe all of humanity have the potential to become prophets, and we just wouldn't know because they also didn't have the Torah's mitzvos with the sacrifices, etc., etc. Or maybe, in fact, many, many millions of people do believe that there were non-Jews who became prophets. One in particular, Muhammad, is not mentioned by the Kuzari, which I think is another indication of what Rabbi Yehuda Halevi felt he was allowed to and not allowed to say in this public book that he's writing in Arabic, because I'm sure Rabbi Yehuda Halevi would have said that Muhammad was not actually a prophet, but if he wrote that down in his book, he could get into a lot of trouble. So he just leaves that for the reader to figure out, I think. that that's what he believes. But anyways, besides for all this, I think that, as I was saying, there are other advantages to Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's theory. And a major, major advantage that it has is demonstrated by the context in which Rabbi Yehuda Halevi brings it up a second time. Remember, the Khazar king challenged the Chaver by saying, well, the Jews must not be so great if they worshipped a golden calf. And the Chaver responds by, no, they really were very, very great, super great, the best. But really, this is actually a much broader challenge, the challenge of other religions against Judaism, which can generally be termed as the replacement theory. That yes, it's true, Jews used to be the most favored nation of God himself, who did all kinds of amazing miracles for them, but they've rebelled, and they're no longer worthy of being God's special people. And in fact, you can see, and this actually is something that even today Muslims make a very big deal out of, you can see the fact that the Jews are a rebellious people from the fact that even from the very beginning, they were not following the words of Moshe, their prophet, and so their special status can be replaced by anyone who does adhere to the words of God's prophet. But that's exactly what this book is coming to argue against. The Chaver is saying that such a replacement theory is completely impossible. No matter how far they fall, no matter how egregiously they might rebel, the Jewish people at the end of the day still have this something special to them, this Amar al-Ilahi, that is as much of a biological reality as the fact that plants are plants and animals are animals. So that's what the Chaver is doing when he's responding to this challenge about the golden calf. He's saying that no matter what, even when they've been totally disloyal, they remain the treasured nation of God. So that is all, I think, one major, major advantage, or we could say a motivation for why Rabbi Yehuda Halevi has this theory about the specialness of the Jewish nation, beyond his sort of semi-scientific understanding based on the historical experience. And now I want to mention another one of these advantages that this theory has for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, which is something that he's going to bring up in another 10 paragraphs or so, but it's something that's sort of behind a lot of what's going on throughout the whole book, which is a general question of, remember, how can you tell what's the true religion? And at first, the king of the Khazars thought, well, it can't be Judaism because the Jews are a despised nation. That's in fact the title of the book of the Khuzari. It's the defense of the despised religion. It must be either Islam or Christianity because they're so successful. So throughout the entire book, we have this interesting interplay between what does it mean to be a correct religion and a successful religion. And towards the end of the first book, and many, many more times throughout the work of the Khuzari, this topic is going to come up. And here, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi can actually flip the argument on its head, the argument that the king of the Khazars thought before he had invited the rabbi into his court. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi flips that argument around by saying, well, Christianity is not nearly as successful as they want to be because they claim that they're preaching the gospels to all of humanity. And even if they have many millions of adherents, they're far from getting all human beings on board. But that's what they claim that Jesus was coming to do. And it's the same is true for Muhammad and for Islam. You can say that it was very successful. It conquered so much of the civilized world, but very much not all of it. And it's already been, I don't know, many, many hundreds of years. So actually, by their own measures of what they were trying to do, those religions should be looked at as failures. But when it comes to Judaism, how should we measure its success, its level of adherence? Well, look at what Moshe said when he brought the Torah to the Jewish people. He said that this Torah is only for you. It's only relevant for you who have this special relationship with God, only for you who are even capable of achieving the levels of prophecy. So here are your guidelines for prophecy. But in terms of the belief system, the Torah as a whole, and all of its mitzvos, it's only meant for the Jewish people. And therefore, we can say that Moshe, because he had a much more narrow mission, was actually successful even 2,000-3,000 years later When all Jews around the world still consider themselves to be Jews, they still recognize the faith of Moshe and the Torah because that's what he came for. That's who he came for. As opposed to those other failing religions, you know, even if you say that half the world are Christian, half of them are Muslim, they don't believe in each other's religions, and they for sure knew that there are plenty of other humans living out in, I don't know, China and Africa, who have never heard of either of these. So I think that that is another great advantage that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi could say about his theory, that it makes the Torah unique to the Jewish people. It answers this question of why did God give his message only to this small group of former slaves? It's because the Torah was only relevant to them. That is, I think, another major reason behind Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's racist theory. And now I want to mention another one that I think is most fundamental to the general thrust of the book as a whole. So I already mentioned three motivations. One is that it seems to fit the historical evidence. Two is that it means that the Jewish people can never be replaced. And three is that it explains why the Torah was only given to this small group of people, and that's sufficient to be considered a success. But now I think that I want to mention another one of these motivations behind the theory of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi that really cuts to the core of the book's arguments against philosophy. And that is, I briefly mentioned this before, but maybe it could be that the philosophers will come upon what's the right thing to do in the world. They'll be able to get to some truths, but they won't be able to get to the divine truths. That again, the only way to get the Amr al-Ilahi, the divine thing, is through a connection to God himself, and that that connection is something that exists on a totally separate plane of reality. It's something that works by its own separate logic, has its own rules, and it also has its own people. Just like in the thinking of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, an animal can't really understand the sophistication of human speech and morality and political organization because it's something that's just beyond the capabilities of the animal mind. To that same degree, the whole system of godliness is on a totally different level. On a level that can't be accessed by normal human means, it can only be taught, communicated, and appreciated through a completely separate means, through prophecy. And I think that this is one of the major, major themes of the whole Book of the Kuzari, that divine wisdom is just a totally different kind of thing than any sort of wisdom that can be gained by philosophical reason, or even the experience that's like normal experience that would be accessible to everyone. And he even says in certain places, like, well, you know, we can forgive Aristotle and the other philosophers. They were really doing all right by their standards. And Be'ezras Hashem will speak a lot more about this in the later sections of the Kuzari in Book 4, Book 5. But I think by creating this division between the Jewish people and all other nations of humanity, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi can similarly make this clear break between the type of knowledge that's accessible to them in the Torah versus the type of knowledge that is accessible to everyone that is represented by philosophy. Even though I admit it makes me a little bit uncomfortable, I keep referring to this as a racist theory of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, and I'll come back to this fact that it makes me uncomfortable. I think that is actually something that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi probably expected, even if not quite for the reasons we would say in the 21st century, but just from the fact that you see that he puts in the mouth of the king of the Khazar that he's so insulted and he pushes back on this theory in a couple of places. But I also want to tone it down a bit and point out, what is Rabbi Yehuda Halevi really saying? What really is the difference between the Jews and non-Jews? The main way that this is expressed is through the ability of Jews to be prophets, to communicate with God, But now think about that. I can speak for myself. I have known many, 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 many Jews in my life, and I have never met a single one of them who is a prophet. I've actually met one or two people who they might have thought themselves prophets, but I'm pretty sure they were wrong. But if we go back to the first thing, the first time that the Chaver in the Book of the Kuzari presents his theory, he mentions that converts cannot become truly Jewish in the sense that they cannot become prophets. But I really think it's worth considering, so what can they become? What can they get? He says, Yavo min hatov asher yutav lanu, they can receive from the good that would be received by the Jewish people. You can imagine, again, like going back to our plant metaphors, you might have a plant or a tree that doesn't bear any fruit on its own, but because it's planted together in a whole orchard full of fruit trees, so the same animals that are going to be trampling around and eating those fruits and spreading all of those seeds around, they'll also pick off some of the seeds of the non-fruit-bearing tree and spread those around too. I don't know if that's a good metaphor, but what's the end result here? What's the goodness that comes to the Jewish people? It's not mainly the material success, as the Book of the Kuzari is going to explain further later on. The main goodness that they can get is the Shechina, is being able to connect to God, the source of reality, to become spiritually uplifted. And that's something that's accessible to the convert by virtue of the fact that the convert will become a citizen of the same country, a tree in the same orchard or whatever. And once again, it may be true that the convert, that someone who is not born Jewish, cannot become a prophet. But today, I don't think any Jews who have been living for the past millennium or so can say that they are any better than anyone who converts to the religion, because they're also not prophets. So I think even within this theory that gives some biological superiority, so to speak, to the genetic descendants of the original Jewish people, it's something that really, at least today, has almost no relevance at all. The relevance is only in potential. But then again, I started talking about this. I want to say, what is the potential of a non-Jew? Either someone who converts or someone who is doing the right things, approaching God in the correct way. What is their potential? So I want to discuss this by thinking about a question that you might be having on this theory of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi that non-Jews cannot be prophets, by wondering, is that really true? Is that actually the view of the Torah and Chazal? So one very famous non-Jewish prophet was Bilam, whose story is told in the middle of the Book of Bamidbar. And even though Rabbi Yehuda Halevi doesn't address that directly, I actually think that the question of Bilam is really not a problem. Because if you look at the context of the story, what happens right before Bilam gives his prophetic blessings to the Jewish people? There's the story about his talking donkey. And I think that's kind of how Rabbi Yehuda Halevi would frame the whole story. That it's just completely miraculous, unnatural, one-time event in history. Just like God could make a donkey talk for the sake of proving how much he loves the Jewish people, so too he could make a non-Jew prophesy. It's exactly the same kind of thing. It's just a miracle that is being done where Bilam is suddenly able to do something that, biologically, naturally speaking, he should be totally incapable of. So that's, I think, the most famous story of a non-Jew who has prophecies that are recorded in the Torah. But there are also all kinds of other people. There's, let's say, in the first book of the Torah in Bereshit, God appears to Avimelech in a dream. God appears to Lavan in a dream to warn him against harming Yaakov. And throughout, we see little snippets here and there where it seems like non-Jews are able to get these prophetic visions. And this is where we can take a step back and remember, what is the whole frame story? What is this book, the Kuzari? It is a non-Jewish king who embarks on a religious journey because he gets a true dream from God. He gets this vision, or this message at least, inspiring him to find the true religion. And I think if we look carefully through the Book of the Kuzari, We'll find that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi hints to this in a whole bunch of different places. He says in the second book, Chelek Beis, paragraph Samech or 60, he says that it's perfectly possible to have a true dream that doesn't rise to the level of prophecy. But I think he's even more explicit in the third Chelek, in the third book of the Kuzari, where he talks about the experience of being among the people who have the Shekhinah, engaging in the sacrifices and the temple and being part of that whole system. He says in paragraph Nun Gimel 53 of Chelek Gimel that a result of those sacrifices is that you too could feel within yourself some new spirit of inspiration, or you'll receive these dreams that are true dreams and even have miracles occur for you, which is all a result of the actions that you performed by following the mitzvos and thereby connecting to Hashem, connecting to God. And earlier in Chelek Gimel, he even gives this person a name. He says that there are different levels of connecting to the Shekhinah. This is in, it's actually a very long paragraph in Chelek Gimel. This is passage Yud Aleph, where he uses different terms to refer to these different levels of connection to the Shekhinah, and they're associated with levels of prophecy, like even after there was no longer any prophecy, for example, in the times of the Second Temple, the sages of the Gemara still experienced heavenly voices, a bas kol, some divine instruction, a godly voice that told them what to do. That's just one shade below prophecy. And he says that is the level of the wali, he says in Arabic. It's a bit of a hard word to translate. It's something like a mystic, maybe, or a saint, something like that, which is just a shade below prophecy, where you can still get these messages that are being sent to you directly from a divine source. It's something that I can say for myself, I don't think that I've ever experienced. And now going back to where we were talking about in the first book of the Kuzari in Chelek Aleph, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi uses that same word, the wali, in describing the height to which a convert can reach. Someone who is not a member of the genetic descendants of Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, but if he learns from their ways, if he conducts himself properly, he too can become one of these saints. And the implication is that then he too can also be a recipient of these kinds of divine messages that I think he would say the king himself, the Khazar king, was already privileged with at the start of his journey. I think that this is an amazing testament to what Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, even with his theory of Jewish superiority, believes that a non-Jew is capable of. And before closing off this topic, of course, I have to say that just because this is Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's theory of the divine nature of the Jewish people, that is not necessarily representative of Jewish thought in general or the mainstream of Jewish tradition. I put on the source sheet some really important sources, I think, that push back against this idea, both from times that are closer to that of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. We already discussed this in the episode on Rav Nissim Gaon, that Rav Nissim Gaon clearly has a different conception than Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. The Rambam, certainly, by many respects, considered to be the greatest of medieval Jewish thinkers, says very clearly in his Igeres Teiman that non-Jews, not even converts, even just members of other nations, are perfectly capable of prophecy. He says that this is what we believe about Eov and his friends, that they were all prophets, even though they were not Jewish. And I also put on the sheet some more contemporary views, such as that of Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, one of the greatest rabbis of the past century, who rejects every form of racism as foreign to the ideals of the Torah. So hopefully you can at least appreciate that this is one area, as I always talk about, how I do think that the Rishonim are so wonderful, so important, but this is one area that perhaps we might not want to adopt the views of the Kuzari, I think for reasons that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi would himself consider to be very legitimate. Remember how I mentioned that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's theory is based upon his understanding of science and what he thinks is the empirical reality? So it's on a related topic, another aspect of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's racism. I might say that I didn't discuss about how different groups of people may have different cognitive abilities, that one of the classic commentaries on the Book of the Kuzari, the Otzar Nechmad, points out that we know that this is actually not the case. We know today that human beings from Europe, Asia, or Africa, wherever they're from, they're all capable of logical reasoning. And so we have to reject the ideas of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi that was based on what he thought was the reality. As I said, this is already pointed out by the Otzar Nechmad. If you think back to what I discussed, what are Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's motivations and arguments for his view? I think those are all things that we can appreciate. We can understand why he came to this view. And hopefully I also gave you an idea of, even with Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's consideration of the capabilities of converts and non-Jews, that they're still very much able to join in with the Jewish people on the level of their connection to the Shekhinah, to God's presence, and even without that, have still something that they're able to connect to divine inspiration, be recipients of divine inspiration, even on what I would think is still a very, very high level. After the Chaver explains to the Khazar king that the Torah really was only meant for the Jewish people as a way to help them all become a, like, prophetic community, we might say. And the Khazar kind of goes back and forth on, like, well, isn't that unfair, as we've discussed? One of the last questions he asks is, well, if other people are going to do good things, shouldn't they also be rewarded? And the Chaver says, yes, certainly, of course. We believe that all human beings will be rewarded for all the good things that they do in this life, that they have some relationship with God, that they will be able to continue after their death. All non-Jews can, in theory, receive a portion in the world to come, but that's not really so important. And this gets to another kind of thing that I think is one of the major ideas of this book that I think is especially really, really fascinating. Which is, what does that mean, that the world to come, the afterlife, is not really so important? I mean, it's important, but I should say that better. It's not something that's really discussed. It's not discussed openly in the Torah. He says it's because it's really something that can't be proven. It's not something that's directly related to our current experience in the here and now, in this world. Once again, you see how it's the lived experience of the Jewish religion, both historically and presently, that takes the center stage of what Judaism is all about. What does the Torah promise for following in its ways? It promises that God will be with us. And the outcome of that is going to be all kinds of miracles of the success of the Jewish people, both military success, economic success, all those kinds of things. All of that is an outgrowth of being close to God. That's the real goal of the Torah. And so, of course, that kind of closeness to God will also continue for a person who dies. It will continue after their death. But the Torah is not here to discuss those kinds of things. And he makes fun of the other religions, that the other religions actually don't promise material success as much as they promise all kinds of things in the afterlife. And he kind of pokes fun at them, like, well, sure, you can promise whatever you like in the afterlife because we're not there. Nobody knows what's going to be exactly what and for who and all those kinds of details. So once again, the Kuzari is a book showing how Judaism is the religion of real life, of the actual experience throughout its history when it really did, it meaning the Jewish people, the Jewish nation, really did have this deep connection with God and were guided by the Shekhinah when many of them were in fact prophets and everyone would be able to recognize that, and saying that those promises in theory are still relevant to us today. But ending off this first chelek, or first ma'amar, the first essay of the Kuzari, is the admission that today the Jewish people do not seem to be very successful. They are, in fact, the despised religion. And the Chaver's response to what the king of the Khazars tells him, reminding him that the Jews are in this terribly sorry state, the Chaver's response is a little bit complicated. But it's basically that the exile itself is meant to help get us back to where we were supposed to be, that because we had rebelled, God had to exile us as punishment, but at any point we can actually return to that state if the Jewish people were to accept this punishment upon themselves as part of God's providence, such that even during this time of exile, we can still say, even now, that the history of the Jewish people is the result of God's guiding them through history. That, I think, seems to be the thrust of his message, but it's more complicated than that, and it also relates to many other things that the Chaver and the king will be discussing throughout the rest of the book. But for the purposes of the podcast, we're going to leave the episode here with the end of the first essay of this amazing book of the Kuzari. I had at first intended to have just one episode of the podcast, which is this episode, to just be on the entire book of the Kuzari, but I think I should stick with what I said so many episodes ago, that I am going to try to have these episodes be a little bit closer to being only an hour long so that I can publish them more frequently. And now I should mention to anyone who's been following along with the podcast from previous months that I am very sorry that I had not been able to put out new episodes within the past couple of months because my work has been totally crazy, but I really, really appreciate that so many people who listen to the podcast have reached out to provide feedback. Any feedback at all is welcome. Any ideas that you might have about the Rishonim, I would love to hear. Even if you have complaints about things that I did or said that you think are controversial, which I'm sure that won't happen this episode because this episode was about racism. That's not controversial at all, but you know, in theory, or even the very kind messages that people have been sending me over the past few months, like, hey, are you still alive? Why no podcast? Or similarly, I just noticed recently the really nice reviews that people put up on iTunes, which I had never checked until a few weeks ago. Thank you all so, so, so much for all of that. Again, any feedback or questions or anything like that, you can direct to my email, therishonim, therishonim, @gmail.com. I hope very much, Be'ezras Hashem, that the next episode will be on the next two essays of the Book of the Kuzari, and then I'll do Be'ezras Hashem another third essay, third podcast, I mean, on books or essays 4 and 5. I hope to get those out in the next month or two, but we'll see. Until then, don't forget that I gave you a lot of homework. Hopefully you too will be inspired to actually read the Book of the Kuzari so that you'll be better prepared to hear me talk about it next time on the Rishonim Podcast.